Hello and welcome to another lockdown edition of Into the Wild. During these challenging times, we have changed the format of our shows to make sure we are still able to bring you the nature chat that you need. On this week's show, I spoke with wildlife filmmaker, explorer and field biologist Daniel O'Neill. Daniel has already had an amazing career travelling the world to some of the most remote habitats and environments on the planet. Daniel has developed a huge understanding on what the impacts of the wet markets and illegal wildlife trades can have on wildlife conservation and the planet, and most recently, learning more about the endangered raptor, the Philippine eagle. I hope you enjoy the show and remember to subscribe on iTunes or Podbean, leave us a review or a comment, and follow us on social media at Into the Wild Pod. Thanks very much and enjoy the show. Hi Dan, thanks so much for joining me on this episode. How are you doing? How are you coping with COVID lifestyle at the moment?
I'm good. Thank you very much for having me, first off. It's a weird one, definitely, for sure. I'm used to being planning to go somewhere at this sort of time of the year, so it's a bit mad, but it's exciting looking forward to different parts and different places that I can go in the future.
Is that what you're doing at the moment? Are you kind of like, have you got a big, I'm now picturing you with a big globe and just pinning different pins in around the world.
Yeah, well, like, for the past couple of years, I've been doing this kind of personal mission, finding, like, wildlife holy grails. I was planning to go and look for another one this summer, but I'm looking forward to the new year now and thinking of all the different places I can go, and I really want to go and see, well, hopefully, try and find snow leopards next year.
Oh, so amazing.
Thinking about that.
Yeah, that's it. Well, I guess that's what with a lot of people, isn't it? Like, the year's just feeling like it's just going to reset in September. It'll just be like,
yeah,
can we just have a new year now?
When they extend lockdown, you're like, oh, God. Yeah. Of course, it's important. It's really important. We need to stick to the rules. But, yeah, it's scary times.
Absolutely. Because I said to you a minute ago, like, you're reading through on your website and stuff, the amount of places and, you know, the variety of places you've been to, you must be bouncing off the walls at the moment.
Yeah, I am. I'm stuck in my small room, just like the adventures I can have are mostly on my laptop and my 1 hour of exercise per day. It's exciting. It's a kind of time to like recoup and like chat a lot more to my family on the phone and kind of look back over old rushes, because I've got on these projects and have all of this backlog of animals and stuff. So I've been having fun kind of going through all of that stuff and editing little videos. And yes, yeah, that's the fun part, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is a perfect time for that as well, kind of. Just sitting down and going, oh yeah, there's admin to do as well, isn't there? Let's get back on track with that.
Doing your taxes.
Yeah, exactly. Cool. Well, I guess to start this interview, and it's always a great way to start it with whoever I'm talking to. Like, when and how did your first foot adventure and your interest in the natural world begin? When did that start for you?
That's an interesting one, because when we were really young, my dad got a job out in the States, and me and my brother went out to, we lived there with my dad, and we went into our back garden. We lived in a rural area of California, and there were like banana slugs and hummingbirds flying around, and I used to run around trying to catch them in jars. And then we were only there for like quite a short time, like 18 months, and we came back to the UK, and it was a massive culture shock to me, because it was in that sort of transformative time in my age, in my life, when I'd really come to like get my love of the natural world while I was there, and then coming back it was really, really different, and that just kind of sparked an obsession with what started as those American animals and moved slowly further down to South American animals, and that's kind of where it all started. And then my dad, he was a scientist, but he's a very different type of scientist to me. He was a physicist, and eventually went into computer programming, and he spent most of his working life in a small office, but loved the idea of being completely out in the wild. And so every couple of years, when we were younger, he would rent a boat, and we would go out and we would do some kind of sailing trip.
Oh, wow.
He also loved to sail. That was his biggest passion in his life, was sailing. And we did this really big trip when I was quite young, and we went to St. Lucia and parts of Central America on this big sailing trip, and it was there that I first saw the rainforest, and that really just became that moment that I knew that was the career that I wanted to go down, to explore parts of the rainforest. And that was kind of the big first moment, and
we went
on from there.
Well, that's amazing actually that you said that, because my first encounter with the rainforest as well was in St. Lucia. It's the first time I've ever seen it. Yeah, it was a family holiday. It's actually, you know, just a kind of a chilled holiday, but me being probably very similar mindset to yourself at that age as well. I just wanted to get out there and go and see stuff, go on jungle safaris, and go on drives.
Yeah, so this is amazing. They've got loads of endemic animals. animals, and yeah, it's a really cool little island ecosystem there.
And I think especially when it's so different to what you're used to from seeing it, you know, I'd never been anywhere like that in the world. So kind of, it was, I always describe it to people when I journey back to it, like, it was like the beginning of Jurassic Park for me. It was really like going over that, like, terrain of going, oh, here's the jungle. Like, it was...
Yeah,
like...
completely. No, I totally understand that. I've got pictures that I look back on now of me and that exact time when we first went out there with the guides into the rainforest. And it's me and my older brother, and we're just sat on this little wooden deck looking out over this viewing platform. And it's that moment of just feeling like, oh, my God, wild places really do exist. And it's, and it's that feeling of what it must be like to be, like, an explorer. And I think that's what, like, excites me so much about it, kind of being in a place that maybe, even if people have been there before, you kind of feel like it's your first...
Absolutely.
Anyone's ever seen it.
Yeah, because when you're there as well, there might only be a handful of you around, and you really don't see anyone else. And it is, you, your other senses are heightened with your sounds and these sights and stuff, because you can just hear and see so much in that kind of environment.
Oh my God, yeah. There's nothing like the sound. That's another thing with the rainforest. It's so heightened in every way. It's not just the animals there, but it's the sounds that you can hear from them and the smells as well. It's it overtakes you.
Absolutely, yeah. So your adventures in the last few years, they've taken you all around the world in some of the most unique habitats. Do you have a favourite place you've been to or that you would like to go to see for the first time?
Oh, both of those. But my favourite is got to be Guyana. I mean, it's the place I've been to the most. It's the first place I first worked as a researcher. And it is the most incredible place in the entire world. If anybody ever gets the chance to go to Guyana, they absolutely should. It's a small country. It's about the size of... It's a bit bigger than the UK in the north of South America. And around 80% of the country is primary rainforest, with almost the entire population of the country, which is that roughly of Liverpool, so 750,000-ish people. And they all live on the small coastal strip and in the capital city, Georgetown. But outside of that, the small population of indigenous people that live in the interior. And I went out into the far, far reaches of that country looking for iconic animals. And most recently, last year, to find a jaguar. Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. That must have been incredible to see that kind of place.
Oh my God, it's absolutely insane. Because it was such a dream for me to go there, and Guyana is one of these places that, like, so many biologists and explorers had gone. At the David Attenborough went there and met the famous otter conservationist Diane McTurk. There's so much history in that country, and it's known as the land of giants because, oh my God, there are so many giants there. The harpy eagle, the apex aerial predator of the Amazon, jaguar, the same but for the land, giant river otters, the Goliath bird-eating spider, the largest spider in the world.
Did you see that?
Yeah. Did I see one?
Yeah.
Yes, I have seen a giant. Got very, very close to a Goliath bird-eating spider. They're amazing, but scary, scary blighters.
That's the thing, like, something, like, in our other episodes, whenever we're talking about an animal, I try and put in insects where I can, or, you know, kind of what people consider the creepies of the animal world. And spiders is always
that
one.
An animal can be that big.
How big were they?
They're huge. They're much bigger than the size of your hand. They are huge, great big things. I did a little video with a company called Barcroft, and you can see my close interaction with that that tarantula on that. It's online, but yeah, got very, very close to them. They're huge, and yeah, even though they're called bird-eating spiders, they actually don't eat birds. They're nocturnal predators, but they are, yeah. They could probably eat a bird if one came
if they wanted to. Is that they're those kind of animal that they got spotted doing something once and just got branded for life, weren't they? They're just
I think the early explorers went there and they were like, this is a beast. And they gave it that name just to make people extra scared of it.
I just love how we never change it as well. Like, it's really, we love to hold a grudge for the animal world, don't we? Like,
oh God, the poor spiders.
I know, like, we learn more, but they're like, nope, sorry, you're a bird eater, nothing's changed.
It's got a cool name. I'd stick with that if I was a spider.
Yeah, that's true. People are going to be fearful of you. You're going to be all right.
Badass.
Do you have a favourite animal that you enjoy seeing in the wild, or that you would love to see that you kind of aim for?
I every time I see one, I'm like, this is the animal. This is the one. For birds, it's definitely the Philippine eagle. It's the most incredible animal. Most incredible bird on the planet. It's the only raptor with blue eyes. It has an entirely different evolutionary history to all the other large eagles. So that one. But the jaguar in the Amazon, I mean, when I'd wanted to see a jaguar for 8 years, and I'd been working out in Mexico and in South America looking for them, and it just never happened for me. And other people would come back and they'd be like, we saw a jaguar, we got one on the camera trap. But I didn't ever get that chance. And so that big trip, we basically were living in hammocks and fishing for food and out in the jungle for over a month.
Wow.
To basically get that chance. And it actually happened 3 days before the end. So you can imagine how much just, oh my God, it was getting before the end. But yeah, that was a pretty big one. But for me, honestly, my dream, my biggest dream animal I've always wanted to see is a snow leopard.
Really? Yeah, God, that's going to be up there, isn't it? How close were you to the jaguar? Was this on a camera trap or is this...
No, that was in the flesh. So we were going down the river. Basically, there's this... Jaguars are really difficult to find. In the Pantanal area of Brazil, it's relatively easy to see them because a lot of the time they've either been fed there or they're very used to tourists going down on the boats. But you'll see them in that sort of sandbank hunting the crocodilians in that area. And that's quite common. But to get a jaguar in the rainforest that hasn't seen people before, really in its natural habitat, is really, really, you know, very hard to get.
Yeah.
And what we were trying to do is have that exact experience. So we were drifting down the river every single morning. We'd wake up from our hammock, we'd get up at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, and we'd get into the little canoe, and we would just drift silently down the downstream of the river for a few hours, and we would do the same in the afternoon and the same just before evening. And we did that every single day for a month. In the really remotest parts of this river, we were dragging boats up waterfalls, and every single waterfall you would get up, we'd get to a more remote place and we'd see more animals like tapirs and, and these toucans and huge aggregations of macaws, but no jaguar. And then right at the end, after we'd come back down all of the waterfalls, we still hadn't seen people for nearly 6 weeks at this point, but we just got back, and three bends of the river before we saw people for the first time again, indigenous people fishing. We were pedaling it really fast because we weren't assuming we'd see a jaguar at this point. And then there, sat on like what seemed like a rainforest throne, it was just this huge male, adult male jaguar with a dock tail and a big scar on his lip and a tick you could still see in his ear, giant one. And he was about 100, I would say between 100 and 200 feet from us.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, just sat on this log, and we took it on towards him, and it was an amazing moment, and he just stood up slowly and then sauntered off back into the forest, and that was the kind of, it was all for that moment. So that was
an amazing experience.
That's
a dream for me now, I think. I think you've just set that scene in my head.
You've got to do it. Guyana's just, it just feels like you're going back in time. It's a proper Arthur Conan Doyle place.
Yeah, absolutely. There was a story that... you'll know this better than me in regards to time. I think it was a few years ago or a couple of years ago. The story of the giant Yangtze softshell turtle, and that kind of held a place in your heart quite a lot, as it did with a lot of people. And then you started this project on exploring wet markets of Asia and the illegal wildlife trade. What was it like to kind of see the truth of this kind of, or these kind of areas and this kind of going ons?
That was an interesting one, because when I first saw that, I just read an article. I'd never heard of the giant Yangtze softshell turtle before. And it was this giant, unbelievably huge, I mean, it's the largest freshwater turtle species in the world. And it lived in Vietnam, and it was, and they had this massive, it was so important culturally to them. They basically believed that this big turtle that lived in the lake in the middle of their capital, Hanoi, was Hoen Kiem Lake or Sword Lake. They believed that turtle was what helped them gain independence from the Chinese multiple times, the descendants of this large turtle, and they gave it this name, Ku Ruo, or Great Grandfather Turtle. And it just amazed me that this story existed about this animal that was almost effectively cryptozoology nearly. I mean, for a very long time it was cryptozoology, because they hadn't rediscovered it until they saw it in that lake, and now, and then it died. In 2016, that turtle died, and the species is now pretty much functionally extinct. All the adults left are so old that they're not reproducing. And I just thought that was really interesting that they'd allowed that species of such cultural importance to get to that position. And I found that, and then as I was looking more into it, I realized that actually they have a lot of endangered turtle species there, that they still have a lot of cultural, you know, they still have a lot of cultural importance to the country, but they're eating them and fishing them and poaching them so much. So I went there to kind of learn about that story and see what people were doing today. And that kind of led me down this road of realizing that people, seeing, I'd never really known too much about pangolins before, but I went to this amazing place in the center of the country called Save Vietnam's Wildlife, where they get in huge numbers of pangolins seized from the illegal wildlife trade. Sometimes 200 individual pangolins will come in one shipment that have been seized from the border to Myanmar or to China. And they come in with huge numbers of parasites. They could be covered in ticks. They could have massive snare trap wounds on them. And this very tiny team with very few resources just worked tirelessly to get them back into the wild. And yeah, it just kind of opened this can of worms for me of realizing just how massive the illegal wildlife trade is. And yeah, there's some dark stories that happened there. One I just found, I was just in Vietnam last summer, and one that I heard about was basically all of the shops that used to sell pets, a lot of the animals they would sell are now endangered or listed on CITES, and they won't let them be sold publicly.
Yeah.
And everyone's filming everything, so there's a lot more eyes on them. So all of the illegal shops have now moved on to Facebook, onto ephemeral Facebook stores, or they're on this fluid network of people on the Asian version of WhatsApp, and they sell these pets illegally through these social media accounts.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really amazing. And one of the ones that I heard that they were trying to sell last time I was there in the summer were Arctic foxes in Vietnam.
Vietnam.
Selling Arctic foxes to be pets for people in Vietnam. And obviously they don't fare well in that.
No, absolutely.
It's almost like in Tiger King. I don't know if you saw Tiger King, the beginning, when you see the snow leopard in the back of that man's van in Florida.
Yeah, yeah.
It's that kind of stuff going on behind closed doors. It's just shocking.
Yeah, I braved through that documentary or whatever that show was meant to be. Yeah, that's shocking. I can't believe that on social media sites that's going through.
That's where it's all moved now. Like, so much of the illegal wildlife trade has moved onto social media, onto online markets, and they have different names for different animals. So a pangolin will have one code name, and a civet cat would have another code name, a turtle another, a tiger another, and then those code names might change over time so that they can't be easily picked up and they can't be traced back to people. It's a very sophisticated business. I mean, the illegal wildlife trade is the fourth largest illegal business in the entire world.
Wow.
So, yeah, worth £21 billion a year. So it's a big industry with a lot of people, a lot of intelligence behind it.
And you'd think moving on to social media that would close more doors for them. You'd think that, you know, in 2020 it would be an easier way for people to be shut down on that. I mean, maybe that's my naive way of thinking.
Well, you've seen it on Instagram. Like, Instagram's gotten pretty good at shutting those things down. It can flag those accounts really quickly. But, you know, it's people are smart and they think of different ways to do things, and you know, when you've got a forum like that, they can be used for good and for evil. People can find bad stories happening on those social media accounts just as easily as people can use it for bad.
Absolutely. I mean, I guess this is kind of, and I'm not sure if this is an obvious question, maybe you can give some insight to it, but what kind of impact do these markets and trades have on wildlife conservation, but also for local people as well?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's really difficult. I'm about to do a PhD this year on the sort of impact of conflict zones on wildlife conservation globally and war. But that all led from understanding that when I go to these places, there's always, whether it's historical or present day, there's some kind of connection to conflict that allows it to kind of propagate and get worse. But the markets there, one in five terrestrial vertebrates are now traded by people. And a lot of these places are in these markets. It's really easy for people to go in there and find these animals and sell them. But it's not just, you know, these animals that you find in there, pangolins, civet cats, cloud rats in the Philippines, but they're pulling these animals out of habitats that are critically important for large apex predators. So when you think about, it's not just the tigers themselves that are being sold, but if you take all of the prey items out of a Philippine jungle, then the critically endangered apex predator of the Philippines, the only real large apex predator, the Philippine eagle, has nothing to eat, and they need such giant ranges to breed successfully. So they have such a knock-on effect on conservation. And if people see them there, then it's considered that that's okay. And people who haven't been educated to understand which animals are endangered, they just think that that's okay, and then they'll go out into the forest and do the same thing. I think it's just so important for people to be educated onto which animals are to be protected and which aren't, and I think it might change a lot what people will sell if they knew that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess this is, I mean, I don't think anyone has these answers at the moment, but I think, do you believe, I guess, that from the recent events that we're going to see hopefully a lot of change in regards to especially wet markets around the world?
Yeah, well, I mean, we've seen this before back in 2002. I mean, SARS was a type of coronavirus.
Mm.
And it was, it came from bats, and they believe that this virus came from bats. And there was some kind of intermediary host. We don't exactly know what that is right now. Some people are saying that it might have been a pangolin. But back in the SARS days, that was a civet cat.
Mm.
And so we know that these markets have a connection to zoonotic disease transfer. We know that it's a forum for mutation. It's a forum for these diseases to mutate and to get into people. And I think, you know, it's basically nature telling us that we've got this really unhealthy relationship with nature right now.
Yeah.
And we need to do something drastic and quick to change it. I mean, we need the global ban of these kinds of wet markets, because we're exploiting wild animals in a way that's just not sustainable, and it's unhealthy, and then we're seeing it right now. I mean, people think that these kinds of conservation issues aren't really important for them in their house, in maybe in the UK or in the States or in Italy, but we now know just how much of an effect these things have worlds across. So I'm hoping, even though this is an awful time, but I'm hoping that there could be, you know, some benefit that we move forward and change the way that we interact with the wild.
Yeah, absolutely. Completely agree on that, and I'm kind of remaining to be optimistic on that as well, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to the Philippine eagle, you were talking about that. What kind of, I mean, you said a few pressures there that it was under, but what other pressures are the Philippine eagle under at the moment? What kind of things are the reason why they're so endangered?
I mean, first off, they're amazing animals, and yeah. They really are absolutely fantastic. They're a relatively unheard of bird until, you know, they were in our planet, and they've a fantastic National Geographic documentary called Bird of Prey made about them. But they're amazing birds, but they are the only major apex predator of the Philippines. A lot of people might think that there are animals like tigers there, but actually the Philippine eagle is the largest apex predator in the island. And unfortunately, because of that, a lot of people are scared of them, so they do get shot. There's a lot of instances of shootings. I met an eagle actually that had only one wing because it had been shot in the wing and saved. But they're being protected by the fantastic Philippine Eagle Foundation, where they they're a conservation and breeding program. So they get in loads. I just had a call actually with the director of conservation, who said that they've just got two new eagles that have been rescued. But they basically get these eagles in, they rehabilitate them, and they send them back to the wild. They also do a captive breeding program every year. There are 31 eagles in the center, so those eagles are the kind of pioneers for the breeding of this species. There are only four and 800 individual birds left in the wild.
Oh, wow.
And they need these giant habitats. But the biggest problem for them by far is habitat destruction, because in the Philippines, it's really running rife for plantations, banana plantations. Palm oil is coming in a lot more. So it's all about protecting forest habitats. But that's what's so amazing about the Philippine eagle, because they protect, it's the national bird of the Philippines, and they protect areas just for those birds.
Yeah.
So they're saving everything else that's in the forest just in the behalf of those birds.
Just by that one kind of, I guess, status animal just being saved, you're saving much more as well. Yeah, absolutely.
Mm.
My penultimate question for you, and this is something I ask everyone that we have on the episode, but if you could pass one bit of advice or guidance to, I say the generation of today, but I guess to everyone living in the current generation, in regards to the natural world, what would you pass on?
Maybe that we think that we have to save the planet so much, I guess, but it's also us that we have to save.
Mm.
Because I think we may have a lot of arrogance about ourselves, but actually the world, if we make all of these animals go extinct along with us, the world will bounce back after we're gone. And I think it's about, you know, we need to protect it for ourselves, because we rely on it so much. And I think in the current times we're seeing that like never before. To enjoy it as well, to go outside and enjoy the wild, because I think we're losing a bit of our connection to it sometimes.
So absolutely, yeah.
I think it's the best thing to do in the world, to go out and enjoy nature.
Absolutely. And my last question, COVID aside, because I know everything's on pause at the moment, but what is next for you? What are you planning?
Ooh, yes, COVID aside. I was due to go back to Vietnam this summer. And that's been postponed a bit, but I was going to look into monkey wine. They poach these primates in the north of Vietnam, and they they make monkey wine out of them, these critically endangered langurs that are beautiful, unbelievably stunning animals, brightly coloured. You should look up the dukes, the red-shanked and the grey-shanked dukes. Mm. But outside of that, I run a film festival, a conservation film festival called Wilderland.
Oh, wow.
And we'll be back on tour doing bringing conservation films and happy and sad and funny to the public nationwide when the lockdown comes down and people start going out again. We'll be putting on those festival films for everybody to see.
Amazing. Well, yeah, we'll definitely need that after all this. It'll be nice to have something back to normal. Well, Dan, thanks so much for joining me for this episode. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
No, thanks so much.
No problem. Take care of yourself. Stay safe. And yeah, we'll speak to you soon.
Cheers. Thanks very much, mate.
Bye.
Thanks so much for tuning into today's show. If you'd like to see what projects Daniel is currently working on, then you can follow him at DanO'Neill_wild on Twitter and Dan's O'Neill on Instagram. Until next time, keep well, stay safe, and live the good life.